Hey there, this is John Doe. You're listening to Walk on the Floor with Chris Shiflett.
Wow, you pronounced it right. That's unheard of.
Lucky.
Nobody does that.
Shiflett.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. I'm Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to Walking the Floor, brought to you once again by our good friends at Floyd's 99 Barbershops, the heavyweight champion of barbers. So get on down to Floyd's and get your summer look tight and tell them I sent you. All right, now today is special because on today's episode, I get a chance to redeem myself for the first time that I interviewed Mr. John Doe, where I dropped call after call after call because we were doing a phoner and, you know, whatever. That's like technical interview speak. But it was really embarrassing, and he was really nice about it back then. This was a couple years ago. But he was also nice enough to come back and let me interview him again. And it was, in fact, my first repeat interview. And this time, it was in person, face-to-face. So there were no awkward hang-ups, except for the ones buried deep in my soul. Now, on another subject, the world continues to unravel this week with the Brexit. I'm sure you've heard. I encourage you to check out Glenn Greenwald's article over at The Intercept. If you want to get a different take on it than what you've probably been bombarded with in the mainstream media, Glenn Greenwald, if you haven't read him, he is usually on point. So check it out. Okay, let's sell some cars. You know, there's something about TrueCar a lot of people don't know. And that is, using TrueCar can also help you buy a used car. In fact, there are over 500,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. So whether you're looking to buy new or used, you can get upfront pricing information that empowers you and discounts off the list price for used cars and a better buying experience through the TrueCar certified dealer network. Okay, let's run through this. Over 500,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. And you'll see what other people paid for their car that, you know, for the car that you want. So you can know what a fair price is and feel pretty confident. And with TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing. So you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. Did I mention that they're certified dealers? TrueCar users save an average of $3,279 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app to enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. And now, this. Okay, does anybody need me to explain who exactly John Doe is? You know, I suppose there might be a couple folks out there that do, so John Doe is the singer, bassist, and lead songwriter for Los Angeles' original recipe punk rock band, X. He's also got a long, glorious solo career, and recently put out a new Cosmic Desert-inspired record called The Westerner, and a book. That's right, he's written a book. With the help of a few friends, in fact. And it's called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. I've read it, and I loved it. I loved it so much that it made me kind of nostalgic for that late 70s punk rock scene that I didn't even experience, man, because I was like 7 years old. But that's kind of always the sign of a good book, especially like an autobiography, personal history, oral history, whatever. It makes you wish you were there, and his book definitely does. Make sure you listen all the way to the end of the interview, because John actually let me sit in with him while he plays a song from his new record, and we do a Merle Haggard tune. Oh yeah, this is John Doe on Walking the Floor.
Back before Nixon, I'd do us all on TV.
You know, I don't know how much you remember about the last time I interviewed you.
A little bit.
It was a phoner, yep. And I was doing it via Skype.
Yep.
And my crummy internet kept dropping the call over
oh,
and over.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Yes, yes. Now I remember that.
Yeah. Well, I went back and listened to that interview because I didn't want to ask you any of the same stuff.
Oh, well, that's kind.
Trying to be courteous.
And very, like, doing your job, yeah.
But because I kept dropping the call, we talked a lot about, like, you know, how you got into music and influences mm-hmm. and that sort mm-hmm. of stuff, and, like, mm-hmm. X in the early days. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I was all prepared. I was like, I'm not going to ask him any of that stuff. But then you put out this great book, so I feel like we got to get to that eventually. Oh, okay. But yeah. I didn't get a chance last time to talk to you much about, like, what you were doing currently. And because you have this great new album, why don't we just start there?
We can do that.
With Westerner.
We can do that.
Tell me about Westerner. To me, listening to it, I just got it yesterday, but I've listened to it a couple times through, and it's like it taps into that cosmic. What is going on with your mic?
Just fucking around. Oh,
come on, Renee. Thought we were supposed to be professionals.
That's good.
Here.
No,
okay.
That's good.
Yeah, like it taps into that cosmic American freaky deaky sound.
Yes. There's a lot to say about this, and I can break it down and then expand.
Well, I'm wondering, like, how much if you have a vision of the sort of overall theme and sound and scope yeah. of what you're trying to do before you go into the studio, if you just
not,
let it
not happen. Always,
right?
But this time a little bit more. I mean, there's usually sounds that I've been listening to or things that I think the songs are asking for.
Mm.
But this one is dedicated to my friend Michael Blake.
Right.
And he wrote Dances with Wolves. He also wrote some other great books, but people don't know those as well. He actually wrote a sequel to Dances with Wolves called The Holy Road, which is awesome. He wrote another book called Marching to Valhalla, and it's about Custer going to the Little Bighorn from his perspective. So it's like his...
It's fiction. It's not like a historical... account.
It's historical. It's historical fiction.
Right. Okay.
So Michael did a ton of research on Custer and his egotistical craziness, and he wrote Custer's journal marching to what Custer thought was going to be his crowning glory. Because he had a very checkered past. He had a very checkered history what's the word I'm looking for? You know, his legacy was very checkered because he would do great, amazing things, Custer would, and then he would do incredibly stupid stuff and would get taken down to being a colonel and then he'd be a general. And
so like anyway, he would do amazing things on the battlefield, like
yeah,
huge successes.
He would do huge strategical successes and then he would fail miserably. But going to the Little Bighorn, he really thought that he was going to show him this time. This is going to be his crowning glory.
Right. Didn't really work out that way.
No, not so much. But Michael was a great friend of mine.
Actually mentioned him last time we talked because I asked you about because I'd watched that video of you riding horses.
Yeah,
and I think you mentioned that he was the guy that taught you how to ride horses.
He got me into horses.
Yeah,
he was like an older brother, and he got Alzheimer's, and I was writing some songs about him, using him as a character, writing about his life. You know, I mean, he was like an older brother.
Right.
And definitely a mentor. And
was he around the early punk rock scene in L.A.? Or was this some
sort of
guy you met afterwards?
No, he was... I met him probably in 81, 82.
Okay.
Maybe, yeah, 82, 83. Anyway, so I started working on these songs, and Hal Gelb and I knew each other from years and years ago, like back in the... probably 70s we met.
Hmm.
And then we reconnected probably 10 years ago. And I just thought, what the hell? Why haven't I been friends with this guy forever? And Hal was instrumental in that whole Tucson, you know, Calexico. If it wasn't for Hal, there would be no Calexico.
Hmm.
You know,
I'm not well-versed in that scene. What are some of the...
Well, like Nico Case.
Right.
Calexico, Iron and Wine recorded down there. And there's a great studio called Wave Lab.
Is that where you made this record?
That's where we made... Well, we did the basic tracks there.
Right.
Used some of Hal's players And then I brought my guys that I've played with down there, and we started the sessions again. We did like two sessions.
Who played on it? Did you have Val down there?
I did not. Hal played.
That was his guitar work on that.
Yeah, he played up here. Mm. I did some overdubs with people up in at Dave Way's place. Mm. Dave Way and I worked together on many records. But the Wave Lab is just one big room. You know, there's no separate control room. It's just like
no separate control room. Even wow.
No.
So is everybody in there recording together?
Yeah, and it's big.
Bleed.
It's big and it's nice.
Yeah.
There's some, you know, there's some separation, but we made a point of and this is kind of Hal's signature sound. Is he plays crazy guitar, plays sort of upside down. Mm. The more outside and the more strange pedals that are going, the better. But there's also a lot of distance and there's a lot of space. So we were really conscious of the space.
Yeah, you hear the space a lot in this.
And lots of reverb. And we kind of mirrored the landscape, you know, mirrored the desert by, and that's the sound. But, and it's that, you know, whoosh, 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 whoosh. You know,
right.
It's got some Spanish guitar in it and stuff like that, and that's kind of Hal's signature.
It's spooky.
It's like spooky, and Giant Sand, which is Hal's band, they kind of pioneered that that sound, and his stuff is really linear, not traditional verse chorus, a lot of wordplay, and you'd like his stuff because it's strange.
Yeah, I'm going to dig into that.
Strange but cool.
And how much do you, as a songwriter, go into making a record with all your arrangements sort of wired? Do you do a lot of demos, or do you just kind of go in there and get the group of guys together and see where it goes?
I don't do a lot of demos, no. Enough demos to have them learn the song.
Right.
I'd say it's about 75% done. Yeah, I'll leave a good 20-30% open. I mean, melodies too, vocal melodies.
Right.
Because you want to leave some space to just, you know, wing it and you know, improvise, see where you go.
Right.
Yeah, I mean the most exciting part of recording for me and mixing is being in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a hard thing to do and
you can't force those little magic moments that right. happen, you know, in the recording process.
But being able to know when it's a good one, when it's you're, you know, chasing down a rabbit hole that's not good.
Right.
But that that's fun. I mean, it's exciting and I think I've gotten better at it.
Right.
One can get better at it, but it's the hardest thing because you don't want to get wrapped up in your head, but that's also like
how do you not after a guy that's made, you know, you've made a ton of records.
Oh, I think there's plenty of people, you know, there's famous really famous people who are famous for over intellectualizing stuff.
Oh well, yeah, sure. No, I mean, like, how could you not do that after making so many? It seems like you would just be hard to be to kind of just let go and be in the moment, like you're talking about.
Oh. Because being in the moment is so much more rewarding.
Right.
And you make better decisions. I mean, I'm trying to do that in my life. You know? Not be brainy.
Right.
I don't need to be brainy. I don't need to break it down into a logical thing. I'm much more into shit happens.
Right.
And it happens for some reason that I may never know.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe a little more into some woo-woo, like, I'm going to manifest it, and I'm going to, you know, some Zen shit like that, and just let it happen. Because especially in recording, the more you try to wrench it into place, the further away you're going to get.
Right.
If you just sort of sit back and just see where it's going and then just give it a little nudge on one side and encourage it on the other side, and, you know, so there's so many things like that.
It's horses
are like that. People are like that.
Right.
music is like that. If you're like, I'm gonna grab this guitar and I'm gonna make it do this thing, then you're gonna sound like shit.
Right.
If you just take a breath and you go, I think I'm gonna relax and I'm gonna see where this goes and it's gonna be great. You know, yeah. not in a sounds kind of hippie.
Not in an airy fairy way, but I know what you mean. And that's a lesson that I learned really late. And it's hard, it's much as you can intellectualize that, it's hard to actually apply that in music or in your life either. I mean, I find like I'm almost never in the moment. Unfortunately, I'm almost never like just kind of enjoying what's happening right now. It's always the stress of what we have to do next week and this thing. And then, you're sort of looking back at 10 years ago and going, God, wasn't that great? But at that time, you were totally stressed out, freaking about the future too.
You can get there, Chris.
Yeah, I'm trying, baby. I'm trying to learn from you.
You can get there.
I mean, it sort of brings us to your book, which I assume took you on a very nostalgic path to go back and
a little bit.
Write those stories.
Yeah. I feel like there's more to say about that letting it go.
Oh, sure.
Thing.
Well, yeah, let's say it.
But I lost the train of thought. But anyway, making the book was something that my sweetheart and my friend Tom DeSavia, who co-wrote the book, kind of, he did a lot of the legwork, a lot of the, and he also wrote chapters, and Tom's a good friend of mine. They just harangued the shit out of me, saying, you got to write a book. And it's like, I don't want to write a book.
I think you were talking about that last time I talked to you a couple of years ago.
Could have been, yeah.
Why?
Because we were getting ready to get ready, or maybe we had already started it. But it's like, sounds like a lot of discipline and work to me. I don't necessarily need that.
Right, yeah. I mean, I know that you met Exene like at a poetry workshop or something like that.
Yeah.
So have you been writing this whole...
Here in Venice.
I mean, I know you obviously you write a ton of songs, but have you written,
poetry and
poetry,
writing?
Or memoir, anything, fiction through the years?
Yeah,
have you ever been published before, I guess?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But in literary magazines, like for poetry and stuff like that.
Right. But this is your first book.
Yes, first book.
Why an oral history instead of just a straight John Doe memoir?
Because that's what it turned out to be. Because that in a flash of inspiration, because like I said, they kept saying you should write a book, and I'm not really a raconteur, storyteller, kind of guy. I will tell a story, but they're usually kind of short and have a funny ending or something. And like I said, I didn't feel like having to sit down and write from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. every day. And I also didn't want to have the mantle of historian. I didn't want to be the guy who's saying,
this is how it happened.
This is it. This is the truth. Because I don't believe in truth. I believe that there are so many truths. So in this inspiration that I had, I thought, okay, what's the scene about? The scene is about community. The scene was about collaboration. The scene was about everybody doing their part, whether they were in a band or they made flyers or they did a fanzine or they were a performance artist or they were just a crazy, person who hung around and did shit and was exciting and, I thought, okay, I'll get other people to help me. It's a little bit like Tom Sawyer painting the fence, this is going to be fun. It's going to be really cool. Come on. Don't
come
you
on,
be
everybody.
Part of...
Let's do this.
So, yeah, I mean,
were you involved in that Who Got the Neutron Bomb or We Got the Neutron Bomb book that came out that is sort of a oral history of LA punk rock scene? Did you contribute to that as well?
I did. And in preparing for this, I thought, I don't want to do that because it's been done.
Right.
And that was the same model that Please Kill Me, Neutron Bomb took it from Please Kill Me.
Right.
But I think Please Kill Me had more context and had a little more feeling about what it was like to be in the New York scene. So in people writing chapters, and it's not an oral history, it's a personal history, just not to correct you.
Okay, feel free.
That's what it says. That's what it says. And that's the thing with Please Kill Me and We Got the Neutron Bombs. They are oral histories. There's another one from San Francisco called Give Me Something More. And so, Chris, you and I were in the scene, and you're writing the book, and you say, hey, John, remember that fucking crazy time when you fell down the stairs and you, you know, sprained your ankle? And, oh, yeah, I remember then you, like, pulled out a knife and you cut that guy and blah, 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 bullshit, bullshit. And then you say, okay, man, talk to you later, bye. And then you write, then you transcribe it, and there's no fact-checking. I could say that, you know, there was a pink elephant. And it's also, I'm not really considering what I'm saying. I'm kind of like just talking shit.
Right.
So that was, I mean, that's cool.
Right.
And that's one thing. But what we thought would be better is to give like more sights, sounds, what the city was like, what the, you know, what it felt like, what your heart was saying, what your, you know, what you smelled and what you tasted and, you know, like where you went to eat and, you know, so you really like kind of put people back into the scene.
Right. I mean, it's a great approach to it because that scene, it's not like today. I don't know if we'll ever look back at today in quite the same way that we look back at everything that happened prior to the internet and everybody having a camera on their phone. Because it's a lot of it is, unless you were there, is a mystery.
Yeah.
You know, it's not documented. But it's interesting.
We did get some good documentation though. I mean, even though it wasn't 16 millimeter film and great recording quality and all these kinds of things, there were 6 to 10 really good photographers.
Right.
Which we you know, were lucky enough to get a good section of photographs in the book. There were all the people that that excuse me. All these people that made flyers and a lot of people that saved them. So we had
the
that.
The flyers in the book are great.
We were to put that in there. And you know, unfortunately, a lot of people have died from that scene, but there are still some, you know, good survivors like Mike Watt. And I love the fact that, you know, Mike has got about 8 periods in 6,000 words, and like half of those are like D period Boone, you know, he just like, right, like just right. goes
just
off.
Just rambling.
You know? He just goes off, and it's totally Mike Watt. And the other thing we did is we, you know, said, okay, what are the most important elements of the scene? Where people lived. Most important because everybody, nobody had any money. So you just go over to people's apartment, go over to people's houses, talk shit, drink beer, do some speed maybe, whatever. You know, you just you partied, but it was all about figuring out stuff and creating stuff and just talking. So that was a big thing. So Jane Wiedlin's topic, because she lived at the Canterbury, was about where people lived and how that affected them.
Mm.
So then she gets into some cool stuff about like, oh, well, I wanted to rip up the carpets, but that left a giant gap between the baseboard and the floor, so like every roach and every rat could get in and, you know, feast on the garbage that I didn't take out and should have because I was fucking 18 years old.
Right.
And then
things,
you know,
you don't think of when you're a kid, ripping up the carpet in your dumpy apartment.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was on Hollywood Boulevard. I think the
is
rent,
that building still there?
Yeah, the rent was maybe $200 and there'd be 2 people to each apartment. So like you could panhandle and get $100 a month.
Right.
so nobody had to have, I mean, a lot of people had jobs, but you didn't have to have a strenuous job. but Mike Watts was about, he and Dee Boone kind of creating this music out of nothing, which is what a lot of people did, but also about coming from Pedro, which is like a different country, and coming into the Hollywood scene and then getting steered into the SST, more hardcore scene, and what that conflict was like. So it was a real conflict. The, you know, original kind of Hollywood scene and then the South Bay kind of scene.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was going to bring that up because you have a chapter in there from Jack Grisham, who I love. But there's I think in the opening thing, maybe it's in Tom's opening part, he talks about the L.A. scene not really getting the credit it sort of deserves.
Yeah.
Not as celebrated as, say, New York or London or whatever. That was never my perception. I mean, I wasn't there for it, but it seemed to me that it was what came after you guys that really doesn't get it, the credit. And, like, the bands like TSOL and Social D and Adolescence and all the stuff that was sort of maybe a couple of years later and not part of that original scene. So I was happy to see that Jack's in your book, because he's like maybe specifically one of the guys that's always references like, the punk scene in LA was great. It was all these arty, cool people. And then that guy showed up and it got violent and insane with all his friends. But did you know Jack back in those early days? Was he around? Was he like a little kid at your shows?
Not that I remember.
Okay. No. Uh-uh. So how did he wind up in the book?
Because I wanted to represent that.
Okay.
You know, I think it's, I think that's another book. You better start thinking about that.
Because, that's not my book. My book comes later.
Okay. But
I wish that was my book.
You know, but I mean, the reason we included Jack is because he was part of that, and they were getting the crap beat out of them down on the beach, but so did everybody else. So, you know, that was the thing that we couldn't understand, is that if you want to be part of this group who's going to suffer abuse, what do you care whether they're gay or Latino or whatever? And there was a lot of, like, you're not punk enough coming from that scene. And
sure.
It became a uniform kind of.
Right, right.
You had to play a certain kind of music, and that's not what we were about. We're really inclusive, not exclusive. So right. I think that's what...
it probably drew in a lot of people that just wanted, you know, that were just kind of thuggy, violent people that were thought that that's what just was going on there, that, you know.
Yeah, it's a lot of...
I remember that from growing up in Santa Barbara, a lot of the guys that were the sort of... leaders of the local skinhead movement, like, I don't think they even knew about punk rock.
Yeah.
They just want to go fight people.
Testosterone.
Yeah.
Kind of bullshit. But, no, I love Jack's chapter because it's like, you started this shit. You got us all revved up, and we came up and we finished it, so what's your fucking problem? And he's still unrepentant.
Totally. I interviewed him a while back for this, and he was great.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what's happened, though, is or what did happen, is that was easier for mass media and for the general public to wrap their heads around. It's like the music became a little more similar from band to band. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about SST bands, because they were pretty eclectic. You know, Saccharine Trust and the Minutemen and Black Flag, all very different bands. But as it went on, then it became a little more uniform, and you had a certain kind of look that you know, looked like that guy, and it was all kind of testosterone, not a lot of women in the bands, and you know, that was kind of a bummer, because then people could say, oh, that's just that thing.
There are a lot of women in that first wave.
Yeah.
In LA.
That was one of the things that we did that was great. And there's a lot of women in the book. And
lot of the names of the people that contributed to the book, people will know. Like, of course, you know, Jane and Charlotte from the Go-Go's and people like
right.
that. But there's some people in there that that I wasn't really familiar with. Like, who are like, what was, I guess, Tom DeSavio? I don't know how to pronounce it.
DeSavio.
Tom DeSavio. Or like Pleasant Gaiman or... even Elvez, like I think of Elvez. I remember that from like him being around in the late 80s, but
yeah.
Probably a lot of people picking up the book won't know who these
right.
folks are. I'm
well, guessing. Robert Lopez, who became Elvez, was in the Zeros, which were one of the first punk rock bands.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
He played bass for them.
Okay.
Or no, he played rhythm guitar. Javier played lead, Escobedo, and... They were from Chula Vista near San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
That everyone called them the Mexican Ramones because they played really similar. They had a few unbelievable songs, like great hit songs. You're a Wimp is one of them. Don't Push Me Around's another. They all wore dark glasses. They were like 18. They'd be going to high school and then they go play punk rock gigs on the weekend.
Nice.
It was awesome. And Pleasant was someone who did a fanzine called Lobotomy. Then she was in a band called the Screaming Sirens.
That's what I knew that name from back.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that
right.
her name mentioned in
Rosie
the band
Flores was in that band. Who's
right.
who's still playing? And Pleasant's actually written a couple of books. She's also now she's a belly dancer,
okay.
and has been for many years. She's very fit. She's looking good. but. Pleasant always had this kind of crazy wild, party central. She would stir the shit, no doubt.
I haven't gotten to that part in the book because, you know, I just got the book yesterday, so I only read the first few chapters.
Yeah. No, Pleasance is great. And Jane Wheedland's chapter is kind of dirty, kind of very sensational.
Right.
And then there's some other legit writers. Chris Morris was a writer for the LA Reader at the time. Christine McKenna was a writer for the LA Times, and she's gone on to do several books, and so is Chris Morris. And then there's like Henry Rollins, some of the boldface names, and Exene, and who else? Chris D from the Flesh Eaters. He's got a chapter. But yeah, it's pretty evenly distributed between men and women because it was a big part. You know, it was very inclusive, and it was the first time that there was, women guitar players, women bass players, women drummers, and you know, the Go-Go's came out of that whole scene. And, you know, whether they kept their punk rock, they're punk rockers, trust me. But, you know, whether they became like America's sweethearts or not, you know, they did their own thing, you know.
Sure.
And they were kind of doing that surfy, poppy thing back in the day, you know, right. Back when they first started, so... Yeah,
I've never actually listened to the really early Go-Go stuff. You know, from when they were part of the
punk similar.
Rock. Is it along
it's
the similar. Same lines?
It's a little faster and it's a little kookier, and,
right?
And the songs aren't as they aren't as realized,
right? Those records hold up. I mean, I think from that era, like great pop records of that era, those are great pop records.
Yeah, but that was the thing. I mean, it's like in New York. Blondie and the Talking Heads and Television and the Heartbreakers and the Ramones, they were all really different bands.
Right.
And the same thing out here, you know. The Screamers and the Weirdos couldn't have been further apart.
Sure.
Even though they were both loud and they're both pretty fast, pretty dramatic and you know, cut a real clear picture of what they were doing, you know, what they looked like and the way they presented themselves. And they were really different than the Alley Cats or the Plugs, which were more melodic but you know, more kind of rock and roll based, and you know, so it was all over the place. And then you know throw in Black Randy and the Metro Squad, which are like this weird digital, like pre-digital funk punk rock shit, and us and Go-Go's, and so I mean that was the other reason I think that people are curious about it. Because it was a pretty eclectic sound.
Sure. Yeah. And with the book being out, I know you just said you were doing a book event last night.
Yeah.
But are you doing stuff with any, like, does that have any of the people that contributed?
Yeah. The thing we did last night was with Charlotte and I, and Tom DeSavio was kind of a moderator. And Jane came down because she was in town. Mm. And a bunch of the photographers were around, so we all signed books after it. It was fun. We're talking about like maybe doing a little tour or something.
And nice.
That'd be cool. But
did the Go-Go's officially hang it up a couple of years ago? Did they have like this is our farewell tour?
They are doing a farewell tour in August.
Oh. Because this needs like a documentary component and a tour component. There's a lot of stuff you could be doing around this, which I'm sure has already occurred to you.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe. You never know.
Well, I mean, you're busy. You got
film rights,
a book, and a record coming out at the same time. So I'm sure you have your hands.
You know,
full.
It was. I'm glad I could get them both together. It's a little more work, but it's like if I had put this book out, or we had put this book out, and then a record came 2 months afterward, they would have forgotten. Oh, we already talked to that guy.
Right,
fuck
right,
that.
Right, sure, yeah, yeah.
So
we would have had you back for a third time.
Absolutely,
I'm telling
you. I know you would.
On a total left turn, I love your version of Silver Wings.
Oh.
Did you ever meet Merle Haggard?
A couple times, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did
got
you
on
ever,
his bus.
Did Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you ever get any feed? Had he ever heard your version of his song?
I don't think he heard that. He heard the Sadies and my version of Are the Good Times Really Over for Good?
Mm.
We did a hopped-up version of that. Kind of like Merle Haggard meets the Gun Club.
Right.
You know? I don't know, maybe you can play that in the... I don't know if you play songs in your podcast.
I usually do a little bit. I will use that as one of my segues.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
It's a good one. Yeah. Merle Haggard, the first time I met him, We'll go on to a Merle Haggard jag because there's no reason not to
do it.
He should have been on fucking Mount Rushmore, except not in except not in the Black Hills.
Who could that have been? That would have been like him and Hank Williams. And you could throw him. No, you could do just do a Bakersfield one. Just do him and Buck. Just do it up in Bakersfield, like Gene Shepard. You know,
Wynn Stewart.
Yeah. Right, Del Reeves. He could be up there.
You'd have to have Roy Nichols on there.
Definitely.
Yes. Anyway,
you could just do Merle Haggard and his band.
Yes,
that'd be fine.
Exactly. Just carve it into the sandstone and it would wash away. Anyway, so there's a guy that he used to work with, Ned Shankman, and he represented Merle as a lawyer when Merle was getting his publishing back from Buck Owens. Mm. And this is after Buck Owens and Bonnie Owens had split, and then Merle kind of... So he was taking his ex, taking Buck's ex-wife and his publishing back, which probably for Buck Owens, it hurt more to lose the publishing. I'm sure from what I've heard. I never met Buck Owens, but so this guy, Ned Shankman, said, hey, let's go see Merle at the Universal Amphitheater. And I think I can, you know, introduce you to him. So I was just over the moon and, he had a big fat joint and Merle's standing outside of his bus and he sees Ned and he goes, my Philadelphia lawyer. Cause there's that, who is it? Woody Guthrie does Philadelphia Lawyer. Anyway, there's a song called Philadelphia Lawyer. So we get on his bus and smoke this joint and I don't smoke weed, but so my heart was going like a mile a minute and I had no idea whether it was because I was on Merle Haggard's bus or smoking
You're
weed.
Stoned but out of your mind.
It was both. You know? And I was trying to just take like the littlest tokes, you know, but pretending like I was taking a long one going, but not actually pulling on it at all. And then just like, and then anyway, I was stoned as hell. And Ned asked Merle to tell this story about the crawfish. And I wish, I mean, Merle was one of those like guys who would hold forth. He would just stand there and just tell this story. So there's some story about him working in at Harrah's up in Lake Tahoe. And he had kind of holed up there for a long time and played all these different things. So there was a guy that was supposed to come and interview him, and they picked him up. It was going to be like a big, you know, many thousand word interview story. And so they picked this guy up. They put a blindfold on him. They said, come to, you know, we're going to pick you up at the airport. They put a blindfold on him. They drove him around for a bunch of different, you know, a bunch of turns, like for 15, 30 minutes, something like that. Then came up to Harrah's and introduced him to him. But the guy didn't seem to be that worried about this kind of stuff. He seemed to be very cool about it. And then they, you know, go through this other stuff, and then they... I forget what else they did, but they they bring him back to this penthouse thing where everyone seems to be having all Merle has dressed up all these guys that work for him into kind of mafia three-piece suits with bulges under their, like they're carrying guns and stuff.
Everyone's
and
this guy's packing. Still,
huh?
Everyone's packing.
Yes.
Right.
And then they talk, you know, then they have some guy says, we want to, we have to have a pre-interview. So he takes them into this other room, and they've flown in like 1,000 crawfish from Louisiana. I mean, this is like what money and insane rednecks, you know, or insane hillbillies do. Flown in all these crawfish, live crawfish from Louisiana, and put them in the bathtub. And then they take the guy into this hotel room with the crawfish in the bathtub, and they say, now, if you don't write good stuff about Merle, something like this could happen to you. Like they're going to throw him in the bathtub with a million crawfish, you know? So, but still, the guy is just kind of like cool. And then they go to this thing at the very end where Merle's finished playing, and he goes, we'll meet him upstairs. They go to this penthouse. That's where the guys that are dressed like mafiosos with guns and stuff. And then they have somebody get like $50,000 who had just won at the craps table or something and had been there all night and had won like 50 grand or something. And then they pretended that was Merle's pay for the night. And then Merle comes in and they give it to this guy who's got like, he's just the you know, stage manager or something. But they dress him up like he's the fucking Don. Right. He's the godfather. And then Merle comes up and goes, here's my pay, sir. And pretends that like he's giving the godfather his pay. And then they go off and do the interview and they can't figure out like this guy doesn't crack once.
Right.
He's just cool as a cucumber.
Yeah.
And they find out later that he had been let out of jail like 3 months before for killing a cop or something. Like he was the baddest tough guy.
Right. He was just like, what? Hey, feed me to your crawfish, yeah, if you I will. I don't
I've been,
care.
I've been there, you know. Fuck all you guys.
How does a guy that just got out of jail for killing a cop get an interview with Merle Haggard? That's amazing.
I don't care. It was like it was Merle Haggard's story, and I was going like, really? And then what happened? But I mean, he was so generous because he spent at least that amount of time, what I just did, you know, 10, 15 minutes before he's going to go on, just telling, you know, the story that he's probably told a dozen times.
And, professional.
Just to this, you know, this guy that somebody says, yeah, this guy's, you know,
it's cool. He's got this band. He's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I interviewed him last summer. And there was a similar thing happened to me where he got on the bus. First thing he does is pull a joint out of his hat band and spark it up. And I don't smoke weed either. And so I'm on Merle Haggard's bus and he's just like smoking a joint and he offers it to me. And so I kind of had that moment, like, you know, you feel like when you're 16 or something, like the cool dude's offering me his joint. Right. I don't want to get stoned, but am I obligated? Like, do I have to do it? And it's like, hey man, I'm cool. But then, I wound up interviewing him for a while, and he was just kind of like smoking joints throughout the interview. And he was so great. He was such a, just a cool, easy hang, you know? Yeah. But the whole time I was going, oh my God, I'm going to get baked down in my mind. I'm going to have to drive back to LA just freaking out, you know, like on an acid trip on the freeway, which luckily did not happen.
I'm glad.
Yeah. But he could not have been nicer. He was such a sweetheart. He, of course, has no, I'm sure he didn't know like who the Foo Fighters were or anything like that, but he had that sort of a grandfatherly appreciation, like, oh, you guys are doing good, huh? That's great.
Yeah.
Good for you, son, kind of thing.
You know what? If you've been around for more than 5 years or 10, you're glad that someone else is doing good.
Totally.
Because you've seen, you've been there and you haven't, and yeah.
So what's going on with X?
X is playing shows tonight and tomorrow and the next night. And
Where are you playing?
Tonight we were playing at Alex's Bar.
What?
In Long Beach.
Really?
As a favor to Alex.
Wow.
And kind of a warm-up. We have three shows with Lobos and the Blasters.
Oh, okay. Who's playing guitar with you right now?
Billy.
Oh, Billy's back.
Yeah.
Okay. So how's his health? I know he was in...
Billy's health is good. He had... some bladder cancer that was early stage, and he got some localized chemo, and that's when Jesse Dayton came on and played a couple of tours, like 2-3 week tours in the summer.
Did you do some shows with Dave Alvin playing guitar too, or am I imagining that?
You imagined it.
Okay,
it's a good imagination. Yeah,
it would be cool.
It could happen. it could happen, but. Yeah, Billy got that, and he was back. He played all the Christmas shows that we did this last holiday season, and it's great. You know, we're not going to make a new record, probably. We're not going to write new songs, but on the other hand, we've got a new show that we've been doing for maybe about 6 months, maybe since the Christmas time, and Billy figured out a way that he can play both. The deep cuts, the weird shit that we brought in, and some punk rock. So 2 years ago, we started doing this kind of in concert thing where we were doing these deep cuts. DJ was playing marimba, vibes on some things. Billy was playing sax on a few songs. So we were able to play these songs that we never played before because we added another member. And now the guy is Craig Peckham. He played with the Unknowns, and he plays drums on a few things. He plays some rhythm guitar, but we're doing songs like "Come Back to Me," "I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts," "Dancing with Tears in My Eyes." You know, these songs we never played live because there was too many guitar parts, or DJ was playing vibes, and it was kind of important to the song, to the sound. But we redid a few songs, like "Unheard Music," as a little quieter and moodier. Mm-hmm. So it's like a 2-hour show, but it's like really wide and deep and long. And it's strange because, you know, we'll play Johnny Hit and Run Pauline, but we'll also play Come Back to Me, which is a really slow kind of 50s inspired song.
Yeah, totally. It sounds great.
And when, you know, when Billy plays sax, the audience kind of just loses their mind. They're like, what?
Yeah, because they've never seen that, I bet, right?
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. And no no new record, huh? You sound a little on the fence, maybe.
Oh, I don't
probably
know.
Not.
It's because I wish we could do some new songs. I think we got a bunch of
songs in your back pocket.
No, I don't. I record everything that I write, pretty much. But you know, like making solo records is a little more rewarding because you get to play with cool people. You get to have we talked about earlier, a kind of a vision, and you go towards that. You got to have keep it in a certain direction for X. It's got to be a certain kind of sound. You know, I mean, we tried to experiment with doing some other weirder stuff, and it wasn't really like as X-centric.
Right.
But we did just get a bunch of live tapes from when we toured with Pearl Jam. So I think we're going to put something out with that.
Oh, great.
Because we did, 30 shows with them or something like that. And they have a, you know, full on recording setup for every show. Cause they're big, like, you know, they're like the Grateful Dead.
Right.
With tape sharing and file sharing.
So you've got like a world-class sounding live
record. Got really good sounding. You know, we did all South America with them. We did all of Europe with them. Maybe it's not 30 shows, maybe 20.
Right.
But it was cool.
A live album that's actually live. That's unheard of.
I know. Can happen.
Yeah. I remember, as a kid, I remember being so heartbroken. Well, not as a kid. As an adult, when I found out that all the live records I grew up listening to weren't live, I was like, what? It can't be. Speaking of live, like, are you going out on the road solo?
Yes. Yeah. Jesse Dayton and his band are going to back me up. Except I'm bringing Cindy Wasserman, who I sing with quite a bit. And Mr. DJ Bonebreak is going to play drums.
Oh, nice.
And we're starting in Chicago on June 5th. And then 17 shows and 17 days later, we will finish our first leg in Atlanta.
17 shows in 17 days?
Yes.
You trying to kill yourself?
No, I'm not. It's a way that I'm going to take care of myself.
Oh, nice.
It just so happened.
I love it. That's refreshing.
It just ended up that way. You know? We get another... Like, okay, we can take this, we plan to take like this Monday off, and then somebody comes in with like a good offer, and it's like, okay, well, let's do it. And then, well, there's a Wednesday, and I'm like, nope, that's $3,000 in like Virginia, you know, so.
Gotta do it.
We did it.
So that's 17 days of you going, oh my God, I think I'm getting a sore throat.
No.
I gotta take a nap. Where's my tea?
No. I'm past that. Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, you want to play a song?
Yeah, let's do it.
You want to get on board?
Let's do it.
All right.
You're gonna get on board this train. We gotta get on board this train. You might get to choose where you get on board. But we gotta get on board this train. You can choose your seat on this train. You can choose your seat on this train. You can look out the window, stand in the aisle. But we gotta get on board this train. Reserved, 'cause everybody's on board this train. There's a mountain pass and a straightaway. There's a water stop of the day. But ready or not, 'cause here it comes. You gotta get on board this train.
Before noon.
Oh, that was so good, man.
Fun.
Great.
I couldn't hear the lead, but that's okay. I'm sure it was great.
Yeah, hopefully it all slots in there, yeah. That was
cool.
Great, man. Fun. So fun.
Well, what else could we do?
Love it.
Should we do a version of Silver Wings just for the
hell? Yeah, you know what? There's one little tricky chord in there I always wanted to
use.
Silver wings shining in the sunlight, roaring engines headed somewhere in flight, they're taking you away. Leaving me lonely, silver wings slowly fading outside. Don't leave me, I cry. Don't take that airplane ride, but you locked me out of your mind, left me standing here behind. Silver wings shining in the sunlight, roaring engines headed somewhere in flight, taking you away and leaving me lonely. Silver wings slowly fading out of sight, slowly fading out of sight, slowly fading out of sight.
Wow, I got to play with John Doe from X. This is now officially my favorite walk on the floor ever. So if any other heroes of mine are out there and they're listening and they're thinking, maybe I'll go on walk on the floor, feel free to come on, let me interview you, and then let me sit in with you for a couple of songs and just kind of make my dreams come true like Mr. John Doe did. John Doe can be found at xtheband.com or thejohndoe.com. That is the, T-H-E-E, johndoe.com. Or at John Doe from X on Twitter. I think he's out on the road now, rocking and rolling for the people. So make sure you go check him out. And make sure you listen to all the old episodes of Walking the Floor in the iTunes Store or over at podcastone.com. Leave us some reviews if you like it. Give us some ratings. Nice, good ones, of course. And we will see you in a couple of weeks. Adios, amigos!